Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. It's the 21st of March, 3 minutes after 9 a.m., 2012. With me today is Senator Ellis, Olson, and Egan, and we'll be shortly joined, and myself, Stedman, with some of our other colleagues. Up today, Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production Tax. Today, we have invited testimony from the three majors dealing in Alaska's oil basin. We're going to lead off with ConocoPhillips, then BP, and then ExxonMobil. So with that, I'd like to say that we've got both morning and afternoon, and it appears that we'll be finished this morning by looking at the lengths of the presentations. And if any of the committee members have any of the questions or concerns on any of the issues that have come to the table, we can ask them, and I've spoken with the company representatives this morning that they'll be more than willing to get back to us with answers to the questions, and we'll be following them up with an email of committee members' questions. Some questions they should be able to just answer off the top of their head. Some of them they may have to go back and check the data sources or so on and so forth, depending on the complexity of the subject matter. But with that, I'd like to go ahead and invite representatives from ConocoPhillips, Bob Hendrich, Vice President of Finance, Scott Jepson, Vice President of External Affairs, come forward and introduce themselves for the record, and then take us through their presentation. Apparently, there's only a few slides, so what we've been doing in the past presentations is we've been kind of going one slide at a time, do a slide, and then we'll, if the members have comments or questions. Otherwise, the subject matter gets so broad, it's hard to go through multiple slides and then come back and try to deal with the questions. So with that, go ahead and introduce yourself and let us know what you want us to know.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Heinrich. I'm the Vice President of Finance for ConocoPhillips Alaska.
I'm Scott Jepson. I'm Vice President of External Affairs for ConocoPhillips Alaska.
I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the opportunity to testify today. As we understood the goal, we plan to walk through our views on CSSB 192 provisions and our perspective on an acceptable framework for developing improvements to ACES. We'll take each of the five main provisions one by one. We've summarized them as follows: the progressivity change, discretionary production incentive, the increased gross minimum tax, the oil information system, and decoupling. And then Scott will walk through the framework for modifications. First, for the progressivity change, I'd like to address our views on its effectiveness. To clear the chart, this graph represents the split of cash flow between the state of Alaska and the producers across a range of prices. It uses data from the most recent revenue sources book, modeling the effects for fiscal year 2013. The x-axis is the Alaska North Slope crude price rather than the production tax value or PTV. To get to a PTV price that's used in the ACES calculation, you deduct $40 to get to that value. The solid red lines and the solid green lines represent the Alaska share and the producer share at the industry level under ACES, while the diamond marked lines represent the Alaska and producer share under CSSB 192. A couple of other notes. When we talk about Alaska share, that includes production taxes due under ACES, as well as royalties, state income tax, and property tax paid within the state. The producer share is a net after federal income tax, so it incorporates all of the fiscal taxes paid. Main observations are the minimal decrease in the rate of progressivity by 0.05% has an immaterial impact. Not to say the numbers don't seem big on a dollar basis. Our industry works in big numbers. ConocoPhillips alone has invested over $25 billion in Alaska since 2000. On this graph, at the $130 crude price, the reduction's almost $300 million to producers, but that's in the context of the total ACES taxes paid at that price point of nearly $15 billion. It's immaterial. That's less than a 2% reduction. These numbers are similar to numbers that PSC Energy, I believe, has showed. We have a model that incorporate or seems to calibrate pretty well with some of the results they've been showing you as well. So we're not in disagreement with the work they're doing for you. Another observation here is that the producer share is relatively flat across a range of prices. This results from the high marginal tax rate from the progressivity feature of ACES. So you see between $100 and $130, the producer share doesn't move much. That's the part of what makes Alaska investment less competitive or less attractive as prices increase. Even another component of this is a cap on the production tax rate at 60%. It doesn't help much in the price environments we've seen. It takes prices greater than $230 before the cap would kick in, and we don't expect to be in that price environment for quite some time. So neither the ACES or CSFB 192, in our perspective, provide a robust environment for investment.
Hey, before you go on to the next slide, talk a little bit about this one, because I think it's kind of your presentation's broken down in subject matter as we go through the slides.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So a couple things. It was pointed out yesterday when we were having some discussions on some of the dollar terms that when we, from our side of the table, the Alaska share side, we're having a 9.4%, even referenced on your slide here at the bottom, lower left, 9.4% state income tax, but apparently the amount of tax we collect isn't that in that range, and I think forecasted in 2013's budget year from the revenue source book is targeted around $700 million, and we may be on our side of the table a couple hundred or $250 million light on that number, even though, like you're saying here, this $300 million at $130 is a significant amount of money. It was pointed out as insignificant in the change mechanism with the total dollars you're dealing with. But we have a similar issue at $100 a barrel, or 109, I think, is what 2013 is calculated at, roughly. So I'm wondering, on the clarity, what your thoughts are on when we talk about these in dollar terms, not only dealing with the state income tax that I know, at least it's apparent from yesterday's presentation, is not at 9.4% to the Treasury. And then also, on your side of the table, we're always using a 35% rate. What your thoughts are on dealing with the income tax numbers, both in percentage terms and dollars, when we try to sort this balance out between the producers and the state?
Yeah, the other income-based taxes are challenged to because they depend on the situation of each producer or each company you're talking about. In ConocoPhillips' case, we are at the federal level a full U.S. taxpayer, so we have one of the highest tax rates, pay one of the highest dollar taxes of any of the Fortune 100 companies. The state income tax is a little bit different because of the discussions yesterday around apportionment that in some cases result in lower than the statutory rate. But again, each taxpayer's position is going to be different because of the company structures, and it's hard for this purpose to make an assumption on what that is.
There, just for the folks watching at home, the concern that some of us have is that when we went from the tax and royalty system in 06 to the production sharing, or this concession contract that we have now, modified, I guess, and we were expecting certain results in dollar terms out of it, and when we fast-forwarded a year and those dollar terms didn't materialize in the our side of the table, the legislature got a little concerned about that and went back in and tried to look at why we were off, why the presentations didn't reflect what actually materialized. So there is some caution, I guess, that when we, whatever changes we make or we put on the table, that they actually materialize, and that we're not expecting, say, $700 million in property tax, or excuse me, corporate income tax, and then it shows up $250, $300 million light. Obviously, the money's going, in our simple world, between three players, the state, the federal government, or the industry. So,
yeah. Mr. Chairman, just in that context, even for the models used for these calculations, it is a static model, and the variables do change, whether it's prices, cost structures, capital investment, and those do have effects with, through the capital credit programs on this, on the split of cash flow, so to speak. So there are a lot of moving parts that, that will change from the analysis you do today.
Okay. And then, just again, just put, laying the groundwork down, we always want to have some discussion on exactly what we're looking at so we understand it, because we can have similar charts with different underlying assumptions or different underlying participation. Here it looks like this presentation was put together based on the revenue source book, which is what I was just referring to for FY13, and I guess there's also fall FY12. And that's the homogenized numerics. In other words, everybody in the including implications of credits,
yes,
and other deductions. And
Mr. Chairman, that's based on the producer's data from the revenue sources book. It excludes the credits that would be applicable to parties that don't offset against their production tax, so implying they don't have a production tax too. So it's taking the data from the perspective of the producers on the slope.
Okay, the legacy fields.
Of the legacy fields. Well, the slope-wide, some people use legacy fields different ways. It's slope-wide production.
Okay.
Yeah. Anybody who pays a production tax.
Yep. Okay, just so we're clear, because when we wash in the other 400 and some odd million dollars in credits with companies with no income, our percent of the pie shrinks.
That's correct.
Okay, just so we understand what's going on. And then, and I'm just trying to lay the groundwork, so if any of the committee members have a question, just let me know. Also, I'd like to have your company's thoughts. Here we have a price range from 70 to 150, which I personally think is more useful than going out to $230 or $300. So that, I like your X scale. But at what point do you feel that this split, if ever, should be frozen and these lines should run parallel to each other? Or should we not be that concerned about that and always have an upward slope on the Alaska share? We're not going to do a downward slope. Don't get me wrong.
Mr. Chairman, I do believe these lines should parallel at some point, but I think in order to understand where that should be, we need to take a look at all the components that are going to be in whatever legislation the Senate proposes. It's a conversation we'd like to engage in, but I hate to just throw out a number right now without understanding all the other elements that might be attached to it.
We've had testimony from PFC Energy, our consultants, along with Pedro Van Meers, that in a range of around $100, which is your ANS price here, that relationship of the sharing of profit oil seems to be within a reasonable range for currently producing fields. So do you feel that there's an issue at $80 or $100, or the issue lies at $120 or $130 or... 150 or?
Mr. Chairman, the analysis we've done is that if you look at other places in North America where we invest, that number is less than $100 a barrel. You're probably down in like the $70 range.
70, not 7.
70 and right. 70.
And that's in terms of looking at your effective all-in tax rates.
Right. The effective tax rate, which we've talked about here quite a bit.
So the areas where the investment options are more attractive are in the lower end of that price range.
Okay. Okay. We have Senator Thomas, you have a question?
Well, yeah, I was along the lines, thank you, Mr. Chairman, of what you're talking about there. I was just trying to get a better grasp on the chart myself and the idea that we have included everyone in here. I'm curious why each each industry partner doesn't kind of tell their story. I realize you're partners in the various fields, but it would be, I think, give more clarity to us as we look at, because everybody does something a little bit differently, of why you wouldn't just be representing ConocoPhillips and indicating your situation to help us as we work our way through this, understand better, depending on somewhat personal and subjective thoughts on who's more active in exploration and building versus, and I won't use the word even, but just kind of taking advantage of what they're sitting on, that kind of thing. That would be, I would think, more helpful for us in understanding and also and using your numbers versus just using the gross numbers that come out of the resource book, which obviously overlooks some details, and some of those details are rather relatively large details.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, this is forward-looking information. It's ConocoPhillips is not able to provide forecast information at the business unit level in this light because it is material to the company's operations. We're able to do it on an industry basis because the Department of Revenue does provide forecast information on a consolidated basis. But on a ConocoPhillips standalone basis, the projections of this type are not something we would put in the public domain. We do provide a couple of data points, like our next year's capital budget forecast, but in terms of cash flow and forecast cash flow information, it's not something we can put specifically for ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Senator Thomas, the chair, one other thing I would suggest also is that from the state of Alaska's point of view, I would think it would be more useful to look at this as your portfolio. That, when I look at this, and I try to look at it from the state of Alaska's point of view, this is what you see. You don't see the individual company changes, the individual company actions. It all rolls up at a much higher level, and I think what you're going to see at the end of the day, regardless of the granularity of the data that if we could provide you more, would be something akin to this. So you take a look at what the state's going to get. At the end of the day, you've got to sum it back up to something like we're showing you right here to fully understand what it means to the state.
Right. Thank you for that. I would think that that actually you should leave the Department of Revenue to show us what the state's picture is, and you guys would put forth your take on the various tax regimes, or at least the various bills, your interpretation or your understanding of what that does to them, and let the Department of Revenue, if they take issue with that, and also if various representatives. But I understand your approach. I just think that it would be clearer for us to look at it that way, and it would seem to me that when you're talking about what your plans are going forward, in your boardrooms, I don't know that you would necessarily have that same theory that you would be talking for BP and the rest of the industry at Prudhoe Bay and trying to guess what they would be doing going forward either.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, one of the reasons we show this is because it does mirror our own data. This does reflect how it impacts our cash flow, how it impacts the projects that we're looking at on an individual basis. But as Bob said, we can't provide that kind of granularity for ConocoPhillips alone because of considerations with the fact that it's material to the company, and we can't provide it on that basis. But when we take a look at this and compare it to our own internal analysis on ConocoPhillips alone, this is very reflective of what we see in terms of the impact of ACES on cash flow and investment decisions.
So it's somewhat proprietary, you're saying, and that's why you prefer to lump them all in so that people can't.
That's correct, sir.
Exactly what you're up to. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Just to follow up on that, and this comment isn't directed at the industry. It's kind of at the process that we're dealing with here, because we've had multiple presentations for several years from our consultants, including this year, presentations from the Department of Revenue, and presentations from the, from the industry, and we all three entities kind of agree on the model. I think there's been conversations between our consultants and the three majors, so, and the Department of Revenue. So what data goes in and what comes out, everybody kind of agrees that's within a comfortable range so that we can have a policy discussion and we're not arguing over the model. But my concern is I need to have a discussion with our consultants and have, I think, some of this stuff somewhat or some sensitivity tables run, because I think we're overstating the state share and understating the producer share. And the reason I say that, and it's, for instance, the earlier comment on dealing with the income tax as an example, you know, there's probably a $200 to $250 million spread there at $109. And then I'm not real comfortable or exactly where the producer's overall tax rate is at 35% or corporate or some number less, but it moves some of those share numbers. And we've concentrated in some of our discussions on the government take number, which would be the all revenue to the state of Alaska, property tax, royalties, income tax, severance, so on and so forth, and corporate income tax all lumped together. And the consultants recommended a range from 70 to 75%. And we've been using 75% government take at the table here at $100. But I'm not sure that at the end of the day, when we run those numbers, if that portion to the state would actually materialize, it would be. So I'm going to have some discussions with our consultants that will be in town like tonight or tomorrow morning, and how we should address that. And we could continue to go down the road, which we've done in the past, using the 35 and federal rate and the 9.4. But I think the Finance Committee at some point needs to stop, take a breath, and modify the numbers and get a better feel for at the end what impact that's going to have on the state treasury, that we don't get so wrapped up in at such a high level that you know, parts of this doesn't materialize to the state.
Mr. Chairman, I believe PFC is probably well positioned to do that analysis for you. One thing I would keep in mind, though, is in at least the comparables, when you take the state of Alaska's, say, all-in effective tax rate, the other jurisdictions would need to be adjusted the same way. So right now, I believe, at least the analysis I've seen, they've all at least made the same assumptions across the board when you're comparing to other U.S. Locations that may have more attractive fiscal structures. So just need to make sure that analysis is done across the board.
Right, and I think that is correct, that when we look at the comparative appeals, they all use that 35% corporate rate in the United States, or wherever jurisdiction they're in, and then other tax rates. So I understand that, but I want to make sure that the committee doesn't miss the last step to actually try to put it more in reality terms to the state of Alaska, comparing on a homogenized basis globally compared to how much cash is going to be stacked on this table. We might end up with two different things, and I don't want to be surprised or have the committee surprised. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The goal of all of this endeavor on tax revisions is based upon getting more oil into the pipeline. And the governor has a goal of increasing it from 550 plus to, you know, a million barrels. And I'm wondering if Conoco could comment on whether or not they feel that is a realistic goal, and if you can't comment upon that, then do you feel that you can, since we're looking at close to doubling the amount of oil being added to the pipeline, do you feel ConocoPhillips can double their amount of oil in the pipeline?
Senator Hoffman, to the chair. I think the governor's goal is a very challenging goal, but that's a good thing. I mean, challenging goals are good things to strive for. If you only get partway there, oftentimes you're very, very happy with what you've achieved. But in terms of the specifics, in terms of how you get to a million barrels a day, I think it's going to take significant investment in the legacy fields, Prudhoe, Kuparuk, Alpine. It's going to take probably some development of some of the very challenged resources we have out there. Let me first say, I think the drilling that we're doing in the legacy fields is extraordinarily challenged these days. We have wells that are costing $13, $14 million $1,000 a copy, really pushing the state-of-the-art technology, chasing very small pools of oil. But you have some of the heavier oil, like Wessac oil, the viscous oil, which is going to be out there, but it's going to take a lot of money and a lot of effort to develop that. It's going to take some exploration success. It's going to take exploration success potentially on state lands as well as NPRA. We've heard Great Bear's story. I wish them success. The shale oil may be as good as they say, and if it is, that could add substantially to production in the state. It's going to take probably success in the offshore, in the Beaufort and the Chukchi. We're spending a tremendous amount of money for our Chukchi drilling program. And if that's successful, that will have a very substantial impact on our production here in Alaska. Now, some would say, well, it's offshore, it's federal waters, it doesn't really impact the state. Well, it impacts the state in a number of ways. If we're successful in Chukchi Sea, in the good success case, we'd probably end up building a pipeline from the west coast of Alaska through NPRA back over to TAPS. Once you build that piece of infrastructure, you have a tremendous amount of additional exploration potential in NPRA and western lands on state lands. So I wouldn't put or diminish the importance of success on federal acreage, even federal offshore acreage, in which the state doesn't generate any revenue directly, but it will have significant impacts on the state long term, and obviously it will have significant impacts on the viability and long-term financial ability of TAPS to continue operating. So in summary answer to your question is that it's a challenging goal, but I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility, but it's going to take a number of years before we can see whether or not that's actually going to develop.
Well, obviously, if you take into consideration offshore, I would say that goal is potentially realistic, but that given that reduction in our tax structure, I don't think really affects investments offshore, and that's what we're talking about here. What additional dollars are going to be coming in to the state coffers, and is it financially feasible for us to make those changes? I understand that the tariff transportation costs could be reduced and have additional revenue to the state of Alaska, but the basic question people in Alaska are having is, if we make these changes, are we going to benefit from them, knowing that the North Slope Basin has been in decline for close to two decades?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, we have a slide in here that talks about the things that we would do if we saw changes to ACEs that are similar to what's been proposed in House Bill 110. It doesn't have to be House Bill 110, but we would like to see changes that are of similar magnitude. And, our chairman of our corporation and the president of our ConocoPhillips Alaska, Trond Erik Johansson and Jim Mulva, wrote a letter to all Alaskans a year ago and said there are four things that we're going to do. We're going to pursue more drilling across the North Slope. We're going to pursue major projects at Prudhoe Bay with our partners. We're going to more aggressively pursue satellite development at Alpine and Kuparuk. And lastly, and this may be the most important thing, we're going to proactively pursue other opportunities that are developed if we can see a more attractive environment for capital investment. Now, the reason I say that's the most important thing is that those first three things that I mentioned, that kind of gets you to the $5 billion mark that we've been talking about, investment in things like Eastern News at Kuparuk, IPAD, GPP, development in the SAG over in Prudhoe Bay, additional drilling rigs. Those are the activities that get you to that $5+ billion number. But I think that's just the leading edge of additional investment. If you go back 20 years ago, and if you were to ask the engineers and geophysicists and geoscientists, what do you think we're going to be doing in 2012, they wouldn't come up with the projects that we're talking about right now. In a basin like the North Slope, in these huge legacy oil fields, our engineers, geologists, geoscientists, they're going to come up with additional opportunities for investment. So I'm confident that if we can have a more attractive environment for capital investment, you're building the framework for a long-term healthy oil business on the North Slope, and you will see multiple returns in terms of that capital that comes to the state for additional investment. We've done some rough estimates about how much additional revenue we generate for every dollar of capital investment in them. Bob may want to speak to that for just a moment.
Yeah, that's a good point, because a lot of times a comparison's been made to tax reduction equal to capital investment, and that's really not the right comparison. It's really tax reduction equal to what's generated by the capital investment. And while every project is different in terms of the types of returns it generates, the nature of the cash flow, and the timing of cash flow, generally our work has shown it's about a 2-to-1 ratio in terms of the investment dollar, every investment dollar generating about $2 in royalties and production taxes. So it's a pretty strong return from the actual capital investment dollar.
Just if we could just back up to the first part of Senator Hoffman's question. I think Prudhoe's currently producing a little over 300,000 barrels a day, 334 or some number in there. And Kuparuk, which is where you guys operate, are the operators, is about 133. So if we just round it off to 300 and 150 or some numbers, that's easy to deal with here in the public. I've always heard that the three majors always tell us that the place where you want to find oil is where you already know oil exists. You know, go drill in Prudhoe or go work in Kuparuk because we know the oil's there and we don't have the risk exposure. And a 1% increase in Prudhoe's substantially more impact than a lot of the smaller fields that the industry's going after. So how do you move from roughly, I think we're at right under 600, 588 or something barrels a day now, but just call it 600,000 barrels a day. How do you get, and what's it take, and maybe it's later in your presentation, to move Kuparuk from roughly 140,000-150,000 barrels a day to 200,000-250,000 barrels a day. If we're going to stem the first question would be, how do you stop the decline? Then the next question is, how do you keep it at 150, everything else being held constant, so we stay at 600, and the capital investment it would take to do that. And we've asked our consultants to help us with that, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, we do have some thoughts on that. Just in terms of trying to stem the decline, that's going to have to come through additional drilling. You know, it is a finite resource. At some point in time, you are going to go on decline, and, you know, at some point in time, you'll shut down the field. You'll have depleted the entire resource. But here in the near term, I think we do have the opportunity to bring additional resources into fields like Kuparuk, into fields like Prudhoe Bay. It's not to say that we're not doing infill drilling. You know, we are doing that sort of activity right now. But in terms of being able to attract more investment so we can increase the pace of that activity, Alaska right now is a big disadvantage because of the curve that Bob's put up there on this slide. We just don't have the upside here that we see in other places where we're investing money. So, you know, the first steps are to increase your drilling pace. We're looking at other technologies. We're looking at technologies that will make our water flood more efficient. We're looking at technologies that will help increase recovery. You know, the oil field technology does evolve over time, and it is actually fairly sophisticated. We're continually looking at ways that we can increase recovery in these large fields. And you're right, if you can see a relatively small percentage increase, you're going to see some significant results. It's a little difficult right now to predict at what point we're not going to be able to stem the tide of decline, say, at Kuparuk. I think we're getting into the rate right now, into the production rate, where it's going to be a lot more feasible than it was when Kuparuk was producing 350,000 barrels a day and declining, you know, a base decline rate of around 60 or 70,000 barrels a day. At the pace of decline that we're seeing now, the base decline, I think it is possible to at least level it out if we can put additional resources in place there. In terms of getting production out of a field like Prudhoe or Kuparuk, say Kuparuk, up to 250,000 barrels a day, that's going to take development of new resources within that field. I don't know that we can get there with development of the viscous oil and the heavy oil that we see there. You know, as we've talked about in many forums before, these are very challenged resources. We're doing about 15,000 barrels a day from the core area of West Sac right now, and we're going to move into the next best area that we see and probably see similar sorts of results. After you get out of that area, you're getting into areas where you're really going to be pushing the ability to produce the oil under any kind of technology. But I don't mean that to be too pessimistic. What we continue to do is look at technology over time to see if we can find ways to economically produce some of these extremely challenged resources. I don't know that we could ever get to 250,000 barrels a day. I would hope that with some new ideas, maybe we could, but right now I can't lay out a game plan for you to get you there, but I can tell you the things that we will do to try to offset decline and with a little bit of skill and science, maybe see some increases in some of these legacy fields.
And some of these questions, if they come down the table and it's best later on in your presentation, just let us know, because we have, I've glanced through your slides a little bit. But we have had some discussions dealing with the processing facilities and the constraints above ground versus below ground. And can you give us an idea what we're dealing with in Kuparik? You mentioned you're, water constrained with your water flood. Where are the processing facilities in the pecking order of needed capital improvements versus infield drilling?
Mr. Chairman, at this point in time at Kuparik, we don't have any significant capital constraints. On maybe the hottest day of the summer, we have maybe a reduction of 3,000 or 4,000 barrels a day for a short period of time. In the winter time, it might be on an off day around 1,000 barrels or so. We're continuously looking at ways to make sure we can handle efficiently and cost-effectively the production that's available from the wells. But there's not a significant issue there. When it's cost-effective to debottleneck or expand facilities, that's what we do. We've been doing it throughout the life of these fields at Prudhoe and Kuparik, and we'll continue to do that. That's kind of the base operation that we have out there. So I think the real constraint isn't going to be facilities. If you've got the production, you can generally make the economic argument to invest in the facilities to handle that production.
And we've had some testimony for our consultants on infield drilling is profitable at $100 a barrel, in their opinion, in the legacy fields. So I guess the concern is north of that or south of that, or I'm struggling with the testimony from our consultant saying that the industry is profitable in the legacy fields and infield drilling at $100 a barrel, and the effort needs to be other areas outside of existing infrastructure. What's your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, when we make decisions for capital investment, it's not based upon a single variable. It's not just based upon rate of return. It's not just based upon net present value. It's also based upon taking a look at upside long-term cash flow. Again, I come back to this curve that's up on the screen right now. When we take a look at additional investment in Alaska, we don't see that upside. As prices increase, most of the revenue flows to the state. It does not flow to the producers. A little bit leaks to the producer share, but not very much. So we do get capital to pursue our base business here, but it's very difficult to attract the capital necessary to get another rig or two at Kuparik or Prudhoe Bay because of the phenomena we see with ACES right now. We just don't see the upside for that incremental investment. We can go to other places. We can go to Texas. We can go to North Dakota. And we don't have that particular constraint in our investments. It's like if you have two stocks that you can purchase. They're both about the same price. They both have good dividends. But one has limited upside and the other has unlimited upside. Which one are you going to purchase? Well, for me, I'm going to purchase the one that has the unlimited upside, that has a greater appreciation opportunities. And that's essentially the challenge that Alaska faces right now under ACES, is there's limited upside or appreciation for investments here in Alaska.
That opens up some interesting dialogue. Senator Hoffman, I couldn't resist that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then if there were no changes to ACES and we continue down the road of harvesting, we've had testimony before this committee that that would continue possibly for another 50 years. Is that your expectation? Do you think that without changes to ACES, we would continue to harvest and we would see the companies up there harvesting for another 50 years?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. I do take exception to the characterization of our activities as harvest activities. I've worked in places where we did have harvest activities, harvest fields. These are fields we don't see any upside. We have no long-term plans to develop or fully exploit the resources. That's not the case in Alaska. ConocoPhillips is investing about $900 million a year. That's not an insignificant amount. We have multiple rigs running at Kuparuk and Alpine, same thing at Prudhoe Bay. Some of the projects that we've talked about that are being affected by ACEs, like development of the viscous crude, we'll probably do some of that. But under ACEs, it's going to be difficult to be fully exploit it to the extent that we might otherwise be able to accomplish. I think what you will see, if there are no changes to ACEs, are similar levels of activity that we see right now. But the biggest change, if you have changes to ACEs, is you're going to see an increase in pace and probably a greater emphasis on trying to find additional opportunities to develop these fields. It will change the game. You know, and one thing that I would also observe is that if you create a better climate for investment, it won't just be Exxon, ConocoPhillips, and BP that are going to be interested in investing more in Alaska. It's going to be other companies. You know, you see that in other hydrocarbon bases. You saw that in Canada. You see it in Texas. You see it in North Dakota. Admittedly, the North Slope is a more difficult place to do business, but I think if you can change the investment climate, you'll attract more interested parties than you see right now. And once they find things, they'll be able to fully exploit it and realize greater benefits. That's going to make it more attractive for people to come to Alaska, other companies.
A couple points. We've had testimony from one of our consultants, Pedro Van Meers. Can't remember his exact words, so I'll modify him so I don't overstate his position. He was surprised at the little amount of capital expenditures going in and the maximum amount of harvest mode that is underway in the Arctic. So I assume then that you don't agree with that from your last statements anywhere close.
Mr. Chairman, I do not. Okay. I believe that we are pursuing opportunities that are presented to us. Unfortunately, because of the tax environment that we have up here, we're not pursuing them at the same pace as we might otherwise be able to pursue them. I'm not sure where his metrics come from. I'm not sure how applicable they are. If you take a look at what we're doing, say, in Kuparuk, we have state-of-the-art, cutting-edge technology that we're pursuing for drilling. Same thing at Alpine. We're essentially developing new oil fields inside Kuparuk because the technology that we're using today did not exist when we first developed these fields. It wasn't even really contemplated. We're accessing pools of oil that were not accessible 20 years ago with the technology that was in place at that point in time. So in essence, even though it's still the Kuparuk River Reservoir, we're finding pools of oil in there that are only available because of the technology that we've developed. I think we are applying all the resources of our companies in terms of technology and skills to exploit these fields. And I don't agree with the characterization that Dr. Van Meers has put out there with regard to current activities on the North Slope.
That's fine. I think PFC basically referenced the same issue of harvest mode. But we're working through that issue. The other thing is on the comparison of different, even though the presentation today isn't really geared towards comparisons of different basins, it has been mentioned in your last or your previous answer as far as the financial attractiveness in comparison. I could use Texas and North Dakota. But also, wouldn't you agree that you have to take a look at the prospectivity of the basin we have and take that into comparison?
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. And one of the observations I'd make about the North Slope is that it does have prospectivity. The problem is that because of the impacts of ACEs, as I described earlier, on upside, it's not attracting the capital that could otherwise attract at these kind of prices. We see the capital investment treble. I don't know that it would, but it would certainly go up significantly if we saw a change in the tax regime that we see here in Alaska right now.
Okay. Other questions on this? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We might get to this a little later because you do have a slide in here that talks about the investment, but just for you to probably think about is, as I looked at and get some very creative questions from folks. But as I look at the decline at 5% of roughly, let's just use that for an average of 600,000, that's 30,000 barrels a day. I was trying to, in my own mind, figure out how much investment that would actually take and what projects you had on the books earlier on that would offset that. And I don't know if it's a very clear calculation, but I would like your opinion on it. If you're losing 30,000 barrels a day in a year's period of time, let's just say, that would take 30,000 to flatten that, but that's only for a year because you're still having decline of all that other area that was the producer of the 600,000. So I tried putting together something in my own mind, and I was struggling with that because the numbers were staggering as far as the amount of oil that it would take to do that, much less increase it to 1 million barrels a day. So it's more of a question for you to maybe get back to us on is really what you see as what potential money would have to be reinvested in what projects, a little more meat on the bone, so to speak, and showing how you offset that kind of decline. It's really, as I looked at it, and I may have a completely wrong theory in mind, but it just seems staggering to me the amount of oil we were talking about when we talk about even flattening the decline, the new discoveries.
Senator Thomas, the chair. I can't build that up for you as I sit here today, but I can give you an example of just what is possible. A few weeks ago, Bob and I gave a presentation to Senate Resources. And in that presentation, I showed production in the Kuparuk River field from 2000 through 2011. And starting with, no additional drilling, just starting at the point of production in 2000, and then taking a look at where we are today. About half of the production that's coming out of the Kuparuk River field today is a result of the infill drilling, well optimization, production optimization that we've done in those intervening 11 years or so. That's about 50,000 barrels a day. So the numbers are large, the challenge is large, but it's entirely possible to have significant results from increased drilling, increased investment in these legacy fields. But like I said earlier, I can't build that up for you today in terms of what we would do step by step, and we can take that back and take that under consideration.
If I could. We're going to have BFC help us with that too.
Great. I think that's good. And I think you're on track there with saying you looked at the Kuparuk and what was put into that and what that did, but still is declining anyhow. So I think you could probably just build on that particular model and come back to us and show us just what you guys would anticipate, what it would take to even flatten that flatten it out at 180,000 barrels or something like that. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Other questions on slide number 3? Moving right along to slide number 4.
It's a good thing we only have 6 or 7 slides.
Next, we're going to talk about the discretionary production incentive. This is an incentive that is intended to help production that exceeds the prior year's production level. So we've talked a lot about decline already and battling decline. So the incentive portion of this only kicks in after you've already brought back the decline number and only exceeded production levels in excess of the prior year's level. So the key limiting factors we see is you will have to spend billions just to combat that natural decline, just to get to a flat production level to the prior years. That's billions more than are being spent today. None of those billions are going to receive the benefit of this provision. The fact that ACES is paid and calculated at the producer level means that investments in the new satellites that must go first to offset the decline. That production you do bring on is going to have to go to offset the decline in your other producing areas. For example, if we're declining by 25,000 a day, and I bring on a new satellite with 25,001 barrels of production the next year, there's only one barrel of that production actually is provided the incentive under this program, and that's only a 1 year reduction by 3.5% of the overall tax rate, which today is around 40% to 45%. For the barrels that do not exceed the prior year's production levels. Or rather that do exceed prior year's production levels, it's a small benefit, it's a maximum of 1 year in tax rate, and it's not enough to differentially incentivize these risky long-term billion-dollar investments. And the fact that the potential relief is in the, at the discretion of the Department of Revenue, we're not sure how else to interpret the use of the word may in the bill, makes it unusable for incorporating into our project economics.
On this subject, which is, I think, one of the major subjects in the middle of the table, this incremental production question, which follows up on Senator Thomas's last question, you know, what can be done at any cost? And then what are the cost implications of what's going on, not only for the industry but for the state to implement it? There has been testimony from our consultants that this piece of the bill has some moderate impacts but not significant. So, and there's been a request in from the committee to change that $10 allowance to 20 to 30, you know, some variable above 10 to measure the impacts, and then lengthen it in time to see if, you know, if the concept can mature and be more, I guess, more effective. We've also asked our consultants to look at another concept that has been, that was down at the Resources Committee, a tax holiday. And I've given them the documentation on that, to work on that, which is one of the things that's coming in the next couple of days, the presentations on this subject matter. We've also asked PFC to come up with other ideas that they may have to incentivize this production, and we'd be concerned at, again, the cost and the impacts to the state, because we're as concerned about the marginal cost and return issue as you are, just from a different perspective. So what is your solution? I think there's an agreement that this is only marginally effective. We're all ears listening. How do we solve it?
Mr. Chairman, I
and leave the Treasury somewhat intact when you answer the question.
I'll still give you my answer. I really think the key element here is that whatever changes that are made to ACEs, they have to apply to legacy fields. They have to apply to all future investments that we make. I think if you try to get into if you start trying to parse things and try to start separating out decline curves, you get yourself into a really difficult area to try to either plan for as a company or to manage as a state. I think you need to keep it simple. I think you need to make Alaska an attractive place for additional capital investment. As we talked about a minute ago, it's going to take billions just to get the flat. And if the only incentive is what you produce over a flat decline curve, I fail to see that it's going to be any kind of significant incentive at all. I don't see how you can get there. I think the only way you can get there is if you change the progressivity factor, go to tax bracketing, do something to significantly reduce the or make it more equitable, I should say, between the state share and the producer share, such that Alaska becomes attractive for additional capital investment. I don't think it's a very difficult solution. I think it's rather simple. I understand your concerns about impacts to Treasury. Maybe there's some ways to work through that such that it's not significant in the near term. Long term, I think if you attract the investment, the impacts to Treasury are going to be positive, not negative. I think that's what this is all about. But in the short term, when we're investing the capital, production doesn't come on stream with the first dollar of capital invested. You know, it usually takes 3 to 5 years, sometimes longer, 6 or 7 years for some of these larger projects to see significant production. So, you know, maybe there's a way to work through this such that we don't see immediate near-term impacts to the Treasury, but the longer-term solution is to make it simple and make it apply to all the investment in the legacy fields as well as the new fields. You know, when I look at what's been proposed up here in terms of these kinds of incentives, the only real opportunity for investment or to realize this incentive is somebody who has no production in the state and has found some new field somewhere, and they're just starting to bring it on production. That's about the only party that might see any kind of significant benefit to an incentive of this nature.
One of the things we're challenged with is again, recommendations and testimony from our consultants saying at $100 a barrel, we're sitting pretty well, the basin, as far as profitability to the industry and to the state. Also, infield drilling being very popular or profitable to the industry at $100 a barrel. Again, we would agree that 150 the numerics change, or 140, but for practical discussion here, just $100 a barrel. And if we make a blanket adjustment across all production to get at the problem that we're faced here with the production incentives, we end up moving too much cash across the table, somewhat unnecessarily. So that leads us to the more complicated discussion, and I think there's a lot of agreement. We want to be careful of making this tax structure more complicated. It's already too complicated. But that leads to the discussion of the two-tier approach, which is what this part of the bill would fit into. So help the committee with that concept, because I think from what I heard you ask for was to not have the two-tiered approach, but to have you know, one size fits all. But again, we've been cautioned from our consultants that we're going to potentially move too much cash, and we may not get the results we want.
Mr. Chairman, I think as Bob said earlier, if you look at this over the full life cycle of these projects, the state will be positive in terms of cash. I wouldn't disagree with you that if we implemented a significant reduction in severance tax next year, that the state would see a change in its revenues. Long term, though, I think it's going to more than balance out. I think you'll get on the positive side of that ledger. But I do understand the concern that you have to find out a way to manage your way through that. And I don't have a good solution for you today, but it's something that we would be willing to work through with you.
Okay. And I don't know what PFC is going to bring forward, our consultant again, to address this issue, but they're working this language in the bill with different numerics to see if it'll be a little more aggressive in incremental production and other ideas. So again, I just would encourage the industry to give us some input, because we're trying to solve the problem.
Mr. Chairman, one thing I would like to add is, I guess from our perspective, the healthy base business or healthy legacy field business is important to the future development on the slope, because all of the assets that exist today are essentially the backbone for what's going to happen in the future, whether it's even the offshore and the pipeline that may come across the NPRA, or the satellite fields that feed into the existing infrastructure. That healthy legacy field business is vital to the rest of the developments on the slope.
Mm-hmm. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And along that same line, that same concept and the example I used of the $600,000, 5% of it's $30,000, I understand your concern that you would have to produce 30,000 in one barrel to even pick up the 10 bucks on that extra barrel that came. So it doesn't sound like a great incentive, and I would encourage you also to give us your thoughts on how you would structure something that clearly delineated new oil, and other than just taking a number that, okay, this year we produced this much more. Wasn't something that didn't even take any investment hardly. It was just happened almost, or whatever. Something would be helpful for us to try and put into a plan.
Thank Senator you. Thomas, through the chair, I guess I would say that it took a tremendous amount of investment to produce that barrel that we're producing today. We've invested billions and in both capital and OPEX. So I wouldn't say that was a free barrel. We did invest that. We actually invested it under a different set of assumptions with regard to taxes, severance taxes, and so I would say that barrel has high cost to it. It's not a free barrel.
I'm not talking about any free barrels. I'm just saying some way of determining new oil is what it amounts to, and a fair definition of what that would be through examples of your investments made in a particular field or something like that. Thank you.
Also then, for those at home, just coming attractions, we're going to have a presentation from PFC on just the incremental issue. How much is being spent roughly in the basin from a 14-15% decline curve, which we're not at, but how much is being spent to get it to where we're at today, roughly 5-6% decline, and then how much incremental expenditures it's going to take in CapEx to get to a negative 2, negative 1, 0 or whatever to flatten out that decline curve. But my impression, it's significantly above $5 billion over several years. It's $2 to $3 or $4 billion per year is what I expect to be in that presentation. So I think it's going to be a real eye-opener at the table, what it's going to take to do that. And then there'll be a discussion here on, you know, where do we want to go and at what cost. But I would encourage you to help us solve the problem, even though you might always ask for, you know, more all the time. We that doesn't surprise us.
Mr. Chairman, we'll be pleased to try to work with the committee to come up with a solution that does work. But we are trying to be as transparent as we can be, that the issue facing Alaska right now is that under ACES, this is not as attractive a place to invest capital as other locations. And that's simply a fact. I'm not trying to ask for more. I'm not trying to overreach in this particular comment. I'm just trying to be as transparent as I possibly can.
All right. Yeah, don't misinterpret what I said. I just wouldn't expect you to ever agree at whatever rate we set is. I'd be shocked. Just business. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just make a comment, that I think the difficulty in what is being asked, too, is that it's built into it as an assumption that that the tax system that we have up to $100 a barrel is good and competitive. And I think that's what I struggle with as well. There's a big philosophical divide in the Senate right now. You can feel it. Those that believe that simply altering the tax system for future barrels is what we need to do, and new production, as opposed to taking the temperature and the health of the overall tax system itself and trying to improve its health. And I think that's, for me, as you go forward with the bill that you're drafting for this committee, if I get any input at all, that's where my amendments went in resources. It's to try to look at the system as a whole, at every price per barrel. And not necessarily just new oil. So I hope those comments are at least factored in.
Oh, they are. Everybody has 1/7 of one vote at the table. Slide number 6, I guess.
Fine. Last, I want to cover three of the other key provisions. First, the increase in the gross minimum tax. Just to highlight, there already is a minimum tax structure that's built into ACES. It starts at a 4% rate, roughly, depending on the modeling, around $40 oil. There is a comparison done between the gross revenue tax calculation and the net cash margin calculation of ACES. So it exists today. What this provision increases that minimum tax to 10%. And which has the effect of increasing where the gross revenue tax actually kicks in. We're increasing the floor, the point where the floor tax kicks in. So what that has the effect of doing is actually making ACES, we've talked a lot about it being less competitive at the high end, it makes it less competitive at the low end also. More importantly, there's an imbalance in terms of the takeaway from the producers at the low price versus what we've seen on the adjustment and the progressivity rates. They don't feel in balance, understanding that there might be the need to increase the tax revenue from the lower end of the price environment.
Any questions on the floor? Just a quick comment again, and we can go to the next slide, but I think what we'll do is deal with this as one of the last or later issues in the discussion, in the process, because as we change potentially the tax structure on the upper end, it affects how the mechanisms of the floor work. So we'll come back and look at that and measure that. But there is a concern that the state faces. We could have $700-800 million in credits swinging into the state treasury and basically taking our production tax value and turning it negative, which, you know, is a significant issue for us to deal with from a policy perspective at the state level. So
On the oil information system, we agree the information is important to the state, and we provide a significant amount of data to the various departments. We also support the Department of Revenue, who has a goal of upgrading their tax administration system, which will provide information on a more usable format for their and your needs. However, the long list of information on this bill includes data that's confidential and considered to be our competitive advantage in a very competitive industry. Some of the information is interpretive analysis done by our geologists, reservoir engineers, and should not be made publicly available. And it creates unrealistic expectations then by having a list of information that at the end of the day shouldn't be in the public domain. Okay. In terms of decoupling, we're not necessarily against decoupling, but it's not about increasing production rates. It will increase some of the administrative issues, particularly when you get into allocating the cost of facilities that handle both oil and gas. We deal with those today, so we certainly can work through those. What is important, though, clear regulations before the implementation, so we all understand the rules of the game as it goes into effect. And from our perspective, it's really most relevant when major gas sales on the slope occur, and that's still some years away.
But currently, the documentation we got from the Department of Revenue, it's costing the state about $80 million a year today, with virtually no gas going through our system, and forecasted to go over $100 million in the next couple of years, slightly over $100 million a year. And it's a significant amount of cash. So we add these little tidbits together, $80 million here and a couple hundred million there and taxes and a few other things and income tax, we start looking at a pretty significant sum of funds. So it is a current concern, and it's a major concern from this committee when we have large gas sales, when we could have an impact swinging to the Treasury of a couple of billion dollars a year. So it's just an inherited issue from PPT. So we'll work on that together. We're working with the Department of Revenue and trying to come up with a solution how to fix that particular issue in the bill. And my understanding is they're real close on the language, but we'll see when the language is polished up and we have our attorneys look it over.
Now, Scott's going to shift gears a little bit and talk about the things important to us from the perspective of developing the bill further.
Thank you, Bob. I have just a couple of slides just to illustrate some of the issues that we see in Alaska, and also to just reemphasize the things that we will do differently if we can see changes to ACEs that aren't a similar order of magnitude as what we see in House Bill 110. This first slide demonstrates what our capital budget history has been in Alaska for the last 3 years, 2010 through 2012, and takes a look at, or compares it to, I should say, our capital budget history for the lower 48. We've actually talked about this previously in this discussion today, so I won't talk at length about this. But as you can see, we've had about a trebling of investment in the lower 48, and we're about flat in Alaska. And at these kind of prices, one would expect to see more investment in Alaska than what we're seeing right now. And it's not because Alaska doesn't have opportunities. We do have opportunities. I've talked about that earlier today. The real issue is that when we take a look at our portfolio of investments, and we look at more than just one criteria, we don't just look at net present value or rate of return. We also look at things that is cash flow. How does cash flow change as oil prices go up? What kind of upside do we have in terms of value to the company as oil prices go up? We don't see that here in Alaska because of the high progressivity and very high marginal tax rates. We basically have a flat profit profile up here. As I said earlier, a little bit percolates up to the producer side, but the vast majority, even with all the tweaks that we've talked about on state income tax and the rest of it, it still goes to the state of Alaska. So, one of the things that I think will change is if we see changes to ACEs, significant changes to ACEs, this investment profile will go up. Now, we've often been asked, what will you do differently? So I have a slide that will address that, and I'll move on to that if that's okay with the committee.
Before you zip along, we take a look at you know, I take these are the gross rates, like in Alaska, this is the gross spend in capital dollars. That's normally what's presented.
This is our net ConocoPhillips spend.
Right, yeah, dealing with ConocoPhillips. So if we were to adjust those for the 20% capital credit and the immediate write-off of capital expenditures and look at the net dollars and compare that to the net, I'm not sure on the larger bars, you know, exactly what states they're invested in, but I'd be surprised if they allow you an immediate write-off of capital expenditures. For instance, this 12 budget dollar of $4.5 billion, you're not going to be able to take that against your income, plus depreciate it out, and or get a 20% capital credit on that, or do you? And then what if you adjusted these bars, what would they look like to the net dollars?
I guess, you know, philosophically, maybe we should talk about the tax, the severance tax itself. As I understand it, and I wasn't here, Bob and I weren't here when it was done, but it was meant to be a tax on the cash margin. So it was meant to take into account operating costs as well as capital costs to come up with the free cash, and that was that was taxed at a very high rate. So when we take a look at it, we don't see that as being a write-off. We saw that as being the mechanism at which you attempted to arrive at your cash margin to apply the severance tax. Others may have a different perspective, but that's our perspective when we look at it. It's not really a write-off. It's just part of the equation. You could have eliminated it from the equation. You probably would have had a different tax rate.
Okay.
And second, on the capital credit side, much of these expenditures do benefit from the 20% capital credit, which, again, was put in place to help offset a high progressivity on the calculation of tax. So they really go hand in hand. The capital credits go hand in hand with the onerous tax rates that are included in provision. It is correct in lower 48, most of those jurisdictions are on a gross revenues tax. So there is no deductibility of capital or capital credits directly for the state production tax because they're still on the systems we previously had here based on gross revenue.
Understand that there's a different way of looking at it. I mean, one way of looking at it is it just an accounting entry? And for instance, you guys deduct the capital expenditure, the 20% off the top, and then submit it in. We don't reimburse you, is my understanding. So I guess in some respects it is an accounting entry, although we could make it where you hand us a check and we hand you one back. But we, you know, we're concerned from our side of the table that the capital credits can swing in against our production tax value and drive it negative at lower rates. So, or the way the current structure is, at very high rates of oil price, we the state could be in a position where we're virtually covering all of the capital expenditures through this. Through the capital write-off and credits combination, and that has been pointed out by our consultants that it is a problem within our structure and an exposure the state should not be faced with. We should have a system that protects the state from that. So, even though we'll agree to disagree on some of the finer points of our 20% capital credit or immediate write-off. But if these were restated, as mentioned previously, wouldn't that capital expenditure line that's a little less than a billion come down to probably a little less than a net of 500?
Mr. Chairman, when we take a look at our capital investments and look at corporate borrowing for the company, we borrow, we spend, we allocate the actual dollar for the project. In terms of how we take a look at the capital credit, we apply it to the tax burden that we have. So it is different ways of looking at it, but from our perspective, when we talk to Wall Street and say, how much are we spending in Alaska, this is what we show them, because this is what our obligations are from the corporate treasury to fund our operations here in Alaska. The way you're characterizing, I understand where you're coming from, but it's not functionally the way we operate. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we would have different numbers that we show to the public. And these are the numbers that we use.
No, I mean, I'd agree with you. These are the gross numbers. I mean, I'm not questioning that. I'm just, you know, curious about the net.
Yeah.
And the net is, you know, a subject matter that's brought up by our consultants quite a bit, because we need to understand the impact of the credits and the immediate write-off to the point where we've even struggled here at the table to make sure that when we look at the expenditure side of the state dealing with our oil basin, that we are in fact seeing all of the credits that are impacting the Treasury. Last year we spent some time and some discussion because we were looking at only half of them, missing over $400 million, which is a significant amount. So I know there's different ways of looking at it, and depending on who the audience is, and I don't disagree that if you're making a presentation talking about your capital expenditures, you want to show the gross number because that's what the capital equipment costs you to buy. I mean, I don't disagree with that at all, but I'm just saying from the discussion here dealing with a tax issue, it's broader than that. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this would be a good time just to ask this broad question, and new entrants to Alaska feel differently and respond differently to this question, but just to put on the record, how does ConocoPhillips factor in the credits that are offered here in Alaska when you're making investment decisions? A takeaway for me has been through the testimony and resources in here that you might prefer a reduction in the progressivity rate, bracketing, and a modest reduction in the base rate, and an elimination of credits altogether. And I guess I'd like to hear on the record how you feel about credits, how they influence your investing behavior, because I think the chairman makes some good points. We don't necessarily understand where they all go. And as I think the intent is to be investors, partners with you in those capital credits, but I'm not sure they're working that way.
Yeah. Senator McGuire, through the chair, you are correct. It's every producer and potential investor is going to have a different perspective based on their legacy positions, their own policies, the way they analyze projects. The biggest component that affects ConocoPhillips, we view the priority, is the change of progressivity because of the impact it has on long-term cash flow, cash generation, net income per barrel aspects of projects in later years. Once you get past the first couple of years where the capital credits provided you benefit, you're now burdened with an impaired asset from a profitability or cash generation standpoint. For others, that cash, the effects of the cash credit up front are more important, more material. But when we look at our portfolio, it's the progressivity is the key element.
Senator McGuire, through the chair. If I can build upon what Bob said, basically we look at it as a whole. You know, if changes that are proposed by this committee, we'll look at it as a package, and we'll tell you whether or not that really changes our perspective on investments in Alaska. So there are lots of ways to get at the answer that's going to make Alaska, more the North Slope, more attractive for investment, and we're willing to work with the committee on any sort of mechanism that gets us to where we need to be.
Follow up, Senator McGuire?
Okay.
So I guess the previous discussion was easiest way to, I guess, to put it in a can would be there. You can talk about it pre-tax or you can talk about it after-tax, and I think we need to understand the mechanisms, both pre- and post-tax consequences. And also, I would think we'd both agree that it's the net cash flow that we're both concerned about.
That's correct.
Okay. Now we can go on to the next slide.
Okay. I've actually already covered this slide, but let me just reiterate and emphasize, because there have been those who've challenged our commitment to change our investment on the North Slope if we see changes to ACEs, similar to what's been proposed in HB 110. On the right side is the open letter to Alaskans that came from our chairman, Jim Mulva, and our president of ConocoPhillips Alaska, Trond-Erik Johansson. And in that, they listed these four things on the left side. And I won't go through them again because I've already hit upon these. But what I do want to say is that we're very serious about this. We didn't make this statement casually. We are committed to pursue the things that we've set up there. And if we see the changes that have been described, we will do what we have said. and we are committed to that, and we continue to be committed to that.
And the date of this publication, roughly?
I believe that was about a year ago, about last spring. I can send you the copy if you'd like.
Yeah, I think it was at the end of the last session, roughly.
I believe it was.
All right, and I think as the dialogue has moved on, or the calendar's clicked on, there's been more discussion over capital expenditures, both from the industry and more interest, I think, from the legislative body as far as what it would cost to slow the decline curve.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair statement, you think?
There is certainly, Mr. Chairman, there's certainly been a lot more discussion. These statements here form the basis for the $5 billion number that we've talked about in terms of projects that we would either accelerate or pursue more aggressively if we had changes to ACES.
And you're the, ConocoPhillips is the operator and Kuparik. I'm not quite sure how the operating agreements read. But my understanding is all three major players have to agree on the large capital expenditures. So help the committee tie that loose end together between yourself and the other working interest owners, and are we at risk that two or one may agree or disagree and nothing moves forward?
Mr. Chairman, at Kuparik, the parties that have to approve major capital expenditures are BP and ConocoPhillips. Exxon's interest is too small. They don't really have any influence on capital expenditures there.
Okay.
At Prudhoe, it does take all three parties. And what I would say is, you know, BP and Exxon are going to come up behind us, and you can ask them their level of commitment.
Fair enough. Okay. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments. You just backing up quickly, slide five, you said the oil information system somewhat burdensome, had some problems. At least I would be, and I think probably the rest of the committee would be interested in knowing just what particular items, a little more specificity on what's duplicative and what is considered trade secrets that you wouldn't like to have disclosed, so we could maybe at least work on doing something there. And then
you could stop there just for a minute. Just sure. I want to fill in before you respond back, which I'd like it'd be. Frankly, I'd like the industry to respond to that subject matter and the other ones in the bill. But there's going to be a presentation from the Department of Revenue. They've been working on this subject matter. I think they feel that they've cleared up some misconceptions. They've also gathered information that they hadn't gathered before. So after their presentation, the response back, I think, would be more on point, because we're going to take their presentation and then go from there and how we address this issue in the bill. And that'll be coming, you know, within the next several days. We haven't scheduled it, but Revenue is working on that presentation. Go ahead, Senator Thomas.
And then just on the next step, slide six, I just wanted to make sure the answer to Chairman Stedman's question regarding credits was obviously no, then. Credits are not reflected in these charts.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, that's correct.
That's correct. And then just the last thing, on slide seven, aggressively pursue more satellite developments of Alpine and Kuparik and work with partners to develop major projects at Prudhoe Bay. Would these be projects that would be maybe considered shovel-ready, things that had been put in abeyance due to ACES, or is this something that needs long development periods of time?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, some of these projects have been put aside, as is my understanding. I think BP will be able to address the status of GPP IPAD. In Kuparik, we're trying to continue to pursue, get things to the point where if we can see projects, if we can see changes to ACES that are significant, that make Alaska, the North Slope, a more attractive place for investment, we can start to move on those rather quickly. For example, the NEWS project, the Northeast WestSat project, we're continuing ahead with engineering on that. But when we get to the point where we're trying to look at making long-term, buying long lead items, making commitments to drilling rigs, that's when we'll pause and take a look at, you know, does the investment environment up here, are we going to be able to get the capital that we need to be able to make those large investments for that next phase?
Very
so
good.
In answer to your question, we're trying to be shovel ready, but you know, there's always impediments there when you're not sure if you're going to be able to get the capital that you need to pursue these projects.
Very good. Thank you.
Senator McGuire, did you have a question?
No, I just a closing. I think we're wrapping up. It looks like from the ConocoPhillips testimony, I'm going to ask each of the producers this question. I want you to give the committee your best example of another jurisdiction where you invest that has gone through a struggle over their tax rates, and you've had to work with that particular government. So don't give me the examples of the dictatorships and things, but democracies, where I don't want to hear those discussions, but democracies where that natural tension between the government and the producers has played out and promises have been made about development and it's in fact occurred. Can you give me? And if you can't do it now today, at some other point, a letter to the committee would be great.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I think, you know, the best case in point, one that I think probably everybody on this committee is familiar with, is Canada. You know, they decided that they needed to have a higher take. This is going back, I think, 2007, that time.
Alberta.
It was in Alberta, Canada. Thank you for the correction. And they saw some significant retraction by the industry. Several years later, they changed their tax environment. They saw a significant response from industry in the positive sense. You know, taxes do impact decisions. That's probably the clearest, most distinctive one that comes to mind right now.
Okay. Okay. And you want to finish up slide 7?
Certainly. So just in conclusion, ACES, CSSB 192, as currently proposed, we do not believe this changes the investment climate on the North Slope. If this were passed, Alaskans should not expect to see any difference in behavior than what you're seeing right now. You'll still be faced with the same kind of challenges to attract the capital that we think Alaska could attract if it had a more, if there's more upside that went to the producers than we see currently under ACES. There are a couple of things that we just wanted to suggest to the committee that they consider as you move forward in your deliberations. One, we believe that progressivity needs to be significantly reduced or bracketing needs to be incorporated for the tax rates to make Alaska a more competitive place for investment. If decoupling is included, and we understand your considerations, your concerns, Mr. Chairman, we would suggest that it be implemented after major gas sales, or when contingent upon major gas sales, I should say. And then lastly, and we've talked about this, changes that are contemplated to ACES, we believe very strongly, should apply to the legacy fields. As we've talked about, that's where the greatest opportunities lie for near-term production. I think, quite frankly, you're going to see the largest return for your dollar on these in these legacy fields than you're going to see just about any place else. I don't mean to diminish the accomplishments of ENI and Pioneer, but Kaiachuk and Gurok, they're wonderful developments. These companies took great risks to go out there and develop these, but the combination of those two fields is less than what we accomplish in a year's worth of drilling at Kuparuk or Prudhoe Bay. So it just goes, again, emphasizing that the greatest opportunities are in the existing fields, and I really encourage the committee to, if you make changes, make sure that they do apply to legacy fields. If we don't, I really think we've missed the boat here. And then lastly, we always get asked the questions, and I know you guys know this, you know, but people say, how much do you need? What's it going to take? And we're on the record and still believe that it's going to take changes on the same order of magnitude as we see in HB 110. It doesn't have to be HB 110, but we have to see impacts that we think are going to be in that same order of magnitude to really have an impact on the investment climate on the North Slope.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to address significant reductions. You know, that's been battered around, and we've received a lot of testimony on that issue. And I wonder if we could revert to slide 3 momentarily. And if you look at flattening out progressivity, say at $130, between $130 and somewhat north of $150, that would mean about a $4 billion reduction in progressivity between those two numbers of $130 and somewhat higher than $150 a barrel. Would that $4 billion be significant?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. Bob, I don't understand where the $4 billion comes from.
The $4 billion would be the calculation between $130, which would be about $12 billion, and north of $150 would be around $16 billion. So you subtract $12 billion from $16 billion, and that gets close to $4 billion.
Senator Hoffman, for clarity, so that particular concept is like a cap. It's kind of a cap at, or
freezing the split.
Freezing the split. The problem I see with that is it's at too high a price point, because the issues we see with progressivity are in the bottom, the lower end of the price range, not in the higher end of the price range.
But we've heard testimony all along that the progressivity needs to be changed at the high end. If the price went up to $150 a barrel, and people are saying that it's going to probably go north to even $200 a barrel at some future point, but between $130 and $150 plus, the state would be giving up $4 billion. And I think that seems significant, and that's annually. So in 10-year period, that would be $40 billion if the price of oil were at $155 a barrel in the near future. And we go back to ACES, and when we're talking about ACES, I think the range that we were looking at was between $40 and $80 a barrel. And now we're talking about $80 and $150 a barrel. So it seems to be a significant number to me.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, is your proposal one where you would fix the revenue that the state could get? Because when we talk about modifying progressivity, there's still a progressive element to the tax rate. The state share would continue to go up as prices went up.
No. Flatten it out at 130.
It would be neutral at 130. So the percent split of profit oil would stay the same. So the dollars naturally would increase to both the industry and the state, but the percentage stay constant. Unlike today, where the state percentage continues to grow, your percentage continues to shrink, the industry. Even though your dollars increase is reflected here, your green line goes up, but your percent of the pie goes down. And what he's talking about doing is freezing the percent of the pie, letting the dollars grow equally in percentage terms.
So that would be a cap at $130 a barrel. Whatever the severance tax rate is at $130 a barrel, we simply cap it at that point. Is that
right? Yes, and if the price of the price of barrel of oil was, say, a little north of $150 a barrel, that would be an actual reduction to the state's coffers of $4 billion, and I'm wondering if that $4 billion is significant.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, Bob, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the state share would continue to go up from $12 billion because it's a constant percentage. So if you saw an increase in revenue, the state's revenue would increase. I don't know if $4 billion is the right number or not. But our perspective on this thing is that Alaska is not competitive. You know, it doesn't attract capital at lower prices as well. I agree a cap is a component. If we could cap the severance tax rate at some point below where it is right now, that would be helpful. But I think you also have to take a look at the rate of progressivity. Even at $110 a barrel, I think we're still looking at, 80% type marginal tax rates.
And the effective rate is?
Probably about 40%, 35%. On ACES alone. But the marginal tax rate is still very, very high.
Right. We've had the marginal rate in the middle of the table and out in the public, and the public has been led to believe that the industry is paying a 90% tax rate, which it's not. So I think we're going to try to deal with the marginal issue because of the slope of progressivity. We're working on that. But we're going to pay close attention to the effective tax rate.
That's right. And Mr. Chairman, and at around that 110 mark, I think it's 80% marginal tax rate. It's more the 70% effective all-in tax rate. So there's been a lot of numbers thrown out, some of them related just to ACES, but when we talk about, say, the 80 and 90% marginal, it's the total fiscal take, including federal taxes as well. So we need to talk about the effective tax rate in conjunction with that.
Right. And I think we're going to see some concentration here on the government split, government take number, and then we'll take a look at the tax rates. So I guess I'm $4 billion, is it a significant amount of dollars? Or I guess trying to get back to Senator Hoffman's question, just to be clear if it was answered or not answered. I'm just kind of curious.
Mr. Chairman, $4 billion is obviously a large number. I'm just not sure that I can get to that sink. I would have to see exactly what you're proposing, because when I look at it, I don't come up with that relative change. I want to do it right here at the table, but I'd like to see exactly how that would be arrived at.
We can have that concept run by PFC and take a look at it, put it in dollar terms. And I have asked Department of Revenue to bring in their x-axes, much like you have here at 150, because there is discussion going on capping progressivity at some rate north. I've been using 150. Obviously, there'll be discussion south of that. But for concept purposes, because that's outside of the price of oil, it has never been. So we can get the mechanics understood, and then we can then we'll have a policy discussion. Yeah. So that what his question that he asked is going to be germane to future discussions.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to say I do believe a cap is an important component. It is a way to try to minimize the impact of ACEs. But below $130 a barrel, the environment that we're in right now, we still have issues. Alaska still has problems attracting the capital that should attract because of the shape of the curve below $130 a barrel, even if you capped it at that point.
Okay, fair enough. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to slide 8 regarding the decoupling, and that if decoupling is included, make implementation contingent upon major gas sales, I would think that it would make more sense to have the gas tax in place as major gas sales were being approached and customers were looking at it from a point of view of, you know, understanding exactly what's going to take place, rather than saying, well, we're going to change that tax in the future, that's going to have some kind of effect, we're not exactly sure what it's going to end up. So that seems odd to me that we would not, if you understand our concerns, which you say you do, and I believe you do, that we would not do that sooner rather than later.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, I think our perspective is that decoupling is one of a list of fiscal conversations that will happen with major gas development activities. And it can be implemented now, but our perspective is make it contingent that the start date really at the time of major gas sales. But it's actually part of a package that major gas development activities will have to go through at some point, and I think the governor's referenced the next legislative session.
Okay, thank you.
Just one final point, and I'll let you guys close on that issue. There's significant concern that there's inducements embedded in AGEA that may have been capitalized on by the industry. We don't know, because it's all secret as far as who showed up for the first open season and how much. But clearly those inducements, my understanding is they're alive and well in AGEA. And the concern here is they can be potentially put to the state at the cost of several billion dollars, north of a billion per year. So that is why there continues to be some concern dealing with these inducements. It's risk exposure to the state. So that's why the subject keeps coming up. But it's broader than just future gas sales. It's what do we have haunting us embedded in our statutes and the contractual agreement with TransCanada, and who showed up at that open season, and how much did they subscribe to, and nobody's willing to say a word to us until they send us a bill. I find it unacceptable. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that there's a perspective on progressivity from the people that I represent, which are obviously out in rural Alaska, where they are hypersensitive toward the high price of oil because of the limited amount of deliveries they get every year. And when you start seeing oil prices like that, the affordability and the out-migration from these rural areas is one of those things that is going to happen. And I think that the thing that's lost in the picture is the perspective that they have, that they're out there, that they can't afford to live out there on what they used to before, because they can't afford to go ahead and take the four-wheeler out and go hunting or doing whatever. But what I have been told by the constituency that I represent is that as the price of oil goes up here, we need more and more help for what the state has the responsibility to give to us. As you look at things like water and sewer, where a significant percentage of people out there still don't have a flush toilet that they can go to. When you have airport maintenance, public safety, education, and the schools, including the clinics for the healthcare delivery system out there, their mandate to me is make sure you keep progressivity in place, because as the price of oil gets higher and higher out here, and we can only afford to buy stove oil in small amounts because we can't afford a full tank full, you make sure we have that ability to have those places or those social services that the state is responsible for out there. So that's the reason they are so adamant that progressivity is unchanged, and I think they're correct. I don't know if you have a perspective on that, but I can just tell you what they're telling me about what's going on out there, because I think the high price of oil, as we see it, starts going higher and higher toward $200 a barrel, which I'm not going to be surprised if it's going to be to here in the near future, has an element that polarizes society so that your difference between the haves and the have-nots is more and more significant. And those are the have-nots are the ones that, whether they're in urban settings or rural settings, those are the ones that are going to need the public assistance. Those are the ones that the elderly or anybody that's on a fixed income, they're the ones that are going to need help. And those are the people that I hear from saying, do not move progressivity from where it's at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's more of a comment than a question.
Okay, thank you. Any other final comments? We're going to start with our next presenter here, because I don't want to lose, you know, the 10 minutes or so left. But we're going to take a quick at ease, because we've been sitting now for an hour and 45 minutes. So we'll about 4 minutes from now, we're going to fire off with the next presenter and thank Conoco for coming in this morning. We're at ease. Go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. We've got our next presenter, BP, Mr. Bill Bow. Damian Bill Bow. I put my glasses on, get it pronounced correctly. Anyway, if Mr. Bill Bow can come forward here. He's head of finance for BP, so we'll probably be seeing him, hopefully for the next couple of years. He'll be stationed here in Alaska for several, starting his new job. So we're going to run for 10 minutes because I don't want to lose any time. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take it away.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. My name is Damian Bilbao. I'm the head of Finance for Developments and Resources for BP in Alaska. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today. I'm going to dive right into this, given the time considerations, if that's okay with you. And as you suggested or requested, Mr. Co-Chairman, we'll pause at the end of each slide for questions. So I'm going to talk about three things today. First is around ACEs and why ACEs is not working, and the fact that not just the producers but your own experts and advisors are consistently giving you reason for concern along the same lines. Secondly, I'm going to talk about how more investment is needed to increase production and what that means and what it would take. And lastly, I'll talk about the policy and how it must focus on the long term, not just the short term.
If we stop here, I think the testimony from our consultants has been that ACES works as a harvesting tax structure currently, but it has some disadvantages as far as incremental production. So just to clarify that.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chairman, what I meant was the ACES doesn't work to provide an incentive for increased production. I think the track record reinforces that. Yes. I guess I need two microphones. So, the first thing I wanted to touch on is some OMB data. around the general fund revenue and appropriations forecasted from 2012 to 2022. The graph before you shows expenses in the green bars, and you can see those projected increase through 2022, and general fund revenue, which is forecasted to decline through 2017 approximately, and then go flat. We've taken the liberty of adding an additional line, which takes the 2012 starting point and declines that in line with the 6% production decline assumption, and what that would mean versus the OMB forecast of going flat after 2017. And I think this graph really highlights the point that this is a critical issue that needs to be addressed now, not just for the producers but also for the state. To be able to deliver the OMB forecast in revenue after 2017, you would have to assume that either production goes flat or the price of oil starts to increase 6% a year to offset decline. And I would suggest the track record of the last several years suggests that's not a good planning assumption. Now, whether that it's flat or it's a 6% decline or something in between, the point still remains. It's a significant gap to the forecasted expenses.
I have one question. When you're talking here in your presentation on general fund expenditures, does that include operating and capital?
Those are the general fund expenses, my understanding, those are the discretionary expenses as forecasted by the OMB.
Operating and capital?
I think that's correct. I'll have to check that and get back to you, but I think it's just operating. Let me get back to you during the lunch break. Okay?
Yeah, that'll be fine. I've got a couple comments on the slide, but when you're done with the presentation on it.
Okay. So the fundamental point here is that this represents a crisis for the state, and it's one that needs to be addressed now. In fact, if you consider that in 2012, the break-even price for the state remains over $90 a barrel, I think the bottom line is that the policy that's in place is not delivering the future that Alaska needs to be able to support its infrastructure, the needs of its populations, as well as all the additional requirements that I know you guys spent a lot of time discussing and that your constituents request.
Are you done with the slide?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just a couple of brief comments, especially to the public when they see things like this. I don't, you know, want them to think, one, that we're going to accept a substantial deficit, structural deficit like the federal government, and or ignore it, or that we haven't been looking at this. We have every year for the last several years, at the beginning of our session, have presentations by Ledge Finance where we put up the price and of oil revenue projections along with our break-even numbers. We also look even over to Saudi Arabia to see what their break-even number is in their budgets, just due to their influence in the oil markets, and then take a look at the shifting or the downward projection of our production and how that impacts our break-even budget rates with a concentration on the operating budget, like Senator Hoffman said, because the capital budget we can turn up and down like a light switch, and that we take seriously the forward-looking projections from OMB and our own Division of Finance, but we don't accept them blindly as that's what's going to happen in the future. Because no one in their right mind would run the state straight into the ground, letting their general fund run in a linear projection here. And I don't know what the growth curve is here, if it's 10% or 8 or 6 or whatever. I haven't done that quick calculation to see what that movement up is. But we wouldn't accept that. We would respond to it. In the case in point, a couple of years ago, under the Palin administration, when oil prices declined precipitously over a short period of time, this committee cut $500 million out of the budget to the shock and awe of the third floor at the time, because we weren't going to run deficits. We didn't know how deep or how long that particular financial problem in the oil markets was going to last, but we weren't going to ignore it. So we although we look at this every year, and I would agree that, you know, just running blind that something along these lines could happen, but clearly we would not accept it on the operating fund expenditure side, and we're not accepting it on the production side neither of oil. We're having these hearings trying to struggle with how do we stem the decline of production, and in fact hopefully increment it up a little bit if at all possible. So I just for the public recognition, I wouldn't, you know, we look at this again every January and February and have the discussion here at the table. But it is nice that other people around the state are taking a look at these things too and recognizing that, you know, that some of the struggles we face here at the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have no doubt that the committee works diligently each year like it is this year to make sure that it's looking not just at 1 year ahead but into the long term. And that's precisely why we thought it would be helpful to have this conversation, because fundamentally while the committee will no doubt ensure that the expenses side is managed appropriately, the only way that the revenue side can deliver to cover whatever that expense level ultimately becomes is by making sure that the production is there to cover those expenses. And the only way the production is going to be there versus our track record of the last several years is through increased investment. And that's fundamentally what we're getting at is, as you heard from ConocoPhillips and as we've testified previously, it's only going to be by meaningful tax change that we're going to have increased investment and additional production.
Okay. Any other questions on this? We'll come back to this graph after lunch in case they're just to clarify to the public exactly what it is. And and this will probably be our last slide. We've got a couple minutes, and then we'll adjourn the morning session and reconvene at 1 o'clock.
So Mr. Chairman, I commend the committee's interest in making sure that this is a transparent process. And both Senate Resources as well as Senate Finance has ensured that there's ongoing public testimony, opportunity for testimony from experts as well as advisors of the state. And the consistent feedback from that broad series of input has been that there are serious concerns to the structure of ACES to incentivize investment and deliver the production it needs. Whether that's the competitiveness of Alaska in an international environment, whether that's the system, ACES encouraging harvest versus growth, and growth in investment and production, or evidence that development drilling has been down over the last several years, there's multiple data points here that point to a need for action. And I will say fundamentally, we have a serious concern about the long-term issue. We also have a strong belief that this needs to be addressed now. And we also feel fundamentally that ACES is a failed fiscal policy. It is not delivering on the future that Alaska needs to underpin the future.
Do we have any questions on this slide? Well, Mr. Bilbao, we're going to take a adjourn the meeting. We'll see you back at 1 o'clock sharp after lunch, and we'll continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Pope.